Thank you for the thank you to the Bistowskis for sponsoring. Le'ilo Nishmas Sarah Bas Mendel, 16th yahrzeit of Henry's mother. Hashem should have an aliyah. I do have some handouts here. I'm always weary of passing out handouts in English. We will get to all of it, okay? So you don't have to read it right now. enjoy some of the Hanukkah Nash. There's also some hot water in the other room. Those who would like. Today we're going to cover what I'm calling the Rosh Hashanah Brawl of 1850. And that's not my own personal reference. I think other people have called it that because that's what it was. But in order to understand what the Rosh Hashanah Brawl of 1850 was, we have to first understand the people that were involved in the brawl. So first of all, this picture is not of a woman, that's of a man. That's Isaac Mayer Wise. I would never put a picture of a woman. I'm kidding. Without blurring the face. Without blurring the face. Yes. So this is a picture of Isaac Mayer Wise. This is a younger picture of Isaac Mayer Wise. People might be familiar of his, you know, his later pictures. He had interesting facial hair arrangements even as he got older. I don't know if people have seen the pictures of like his chopped beard or whatever, but either way, this is a young Isaac Mayer Wise, because that's when it happens. Isaac Mayer Wise, you might be well familiar with him for other things, but before 1850, he really wasn't yet a Reformed rabbi. Now, in those times, it wasn't so distinguished, you know, distinctive that, you know, oh, this is a Reformed rabbi, this is an Orthodox rabbi. Coming over from Europe, a lot of the rabbis were just regular Jews. And the question was how they were going to sort of, you know, filter out into the American society. So when Isaac Mayer Wise came over, so I did a little research. Maybe David knows. I'm sure David knows a lot about this, probably much more than I do, even though I just researched it. Isaac Mayer Wise came over from Bohemia. He grew up in Bohemia. I think he was born in 1819, I think, something like that. And he actually learned under a Rabbi Shlomo Rappaport, who was known as Shear. I don't know him very well, but he was very instrumental in what was called the Wissenschaft des Judentum. What was it called?
The science of Judaism.
Right. It's sort of like an academic Judaism, you know, and analyzing text and doing sort of research.
Himself, I think, was
no, that's my point. He learned by a respectable observant Jew. This Rabbi Rappaport married Rav Aryeh Heller's daughter. Rav Aryeh Heller was the Ketos HaChoshen, who was one of like the most, you know, brilliant commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. So this Rabbi Rappaport wasn't, you know, anyone to be suspicious of. But his daughter, he taught Rabbi Wise, and certainly his academic approach was, I would think, somewhat influential on Rabbi Wise's approach later on.
At that time, in Europe, there was already reform.
No, that's true. That's true. There was a distinction in Europe. But in America, they hadn't really, you know, they hadn't settled, you know, exactly what they were going to be when they came over to America. And when Rabbi Wise comes over, he has, at least retroactively, they assume, he had some kind of vision to make an American Judaism, which was distinct and had its own properties, you know, independent of what was going on in Europe.
Even in Europe, who was really shaped?
Yeah, I'm sure there was, but there were more institutions.
The 19th into the 20th century.
But yeah.
Wise came, and I'm saying this not in a complimentary fashion, his arrogance, he thought he was going to, people were going to follow him, and his would be American Jewry.
Exactly, yeah.
He created a prayer book, which he
The American
Minhag America.
Minhag America, yeah. So I don't know when he created that. I know he started it early, but I think it took him a long time. So I don't think he finished it at this point. But the point is that, he had this vision. When he came over to America, I believe in 1838, he came over with this impression that he was going to, you know, galvanize all the Jews. There are not that many of them, but he was sort of going to bring them all under one roof. He was still in his 20s at the time. He was almost basically 30 years old. But this was his vision, that he's going to take over America.
I read that may be unfair. It's not clear whether he actually had sufficient information.
Oh, so there's an interesting, there are a couple interesting letters about Rabbi Wise. There's one in specific, and I didn't bring all of the papers, but in one of the papers that I had, it was a letter from Rabbi Abraham Rice. I think Rabbi Abraham, it was him and somebody else, and maybe the other person had said it, that they're suspicious of his rabbinic credentials, yeah. Although in the paper it said whether he's really a doctor, which I think that meant his rabbinic expertise. Either way, so this is Isaac Meir Weiss. He comes to America, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he's appointed the rabbi of a shul in Albany, She'erit Israel, or She'erit Israel, with the assistance of Isaac Lesser. I believe I read that somewhere. Isaac Lesser was, I think he was the one that wrote that was in charge of the Occident, no?
Yeah.
Isaac Lesser was in charge of the Occident, which was, in many ways, the one sort of common Jewish publication. There were others, the Asmonean, but not as popular as the Occident. And Isaac Lesser was, you know, people were somewhat upset with him, just some things that he published in the Occident and how he leaned a little liberal sometimes, but he was generally, I think, an Orthodox person.
He was the rabbi of Mikveh Israel
in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Ashkenazi part gets all mixed up in America, even this early. But I believe Isaac Lesser helped him get that job in Albany. I read that somewhere, which means it must be true. And then, as time goes on, as we'll read in the Occident, you know, people start to form opinions of Rabbi Wise and that maybe things aren't as they once seemed that they were. So this is in 1838. He makes his way to Albany as the rabbi there. And throughout the years there, he was already trying to introduce some things that were not 100% kosher, or at least not non-kosher. I shouldn't say that they were entirely unkosher, but I would say that they were just different. He changed the general. I'm trying to find if I can. Here it is. So a couple of things. First of all, it said, I believe, I'm trying to find it now, it said that he mixed, let's get some facts straight. Wise came to Albany in the fall of 1846 after having been elected rabbi of Beth-El with added responsibility of administering the congregation school. Oh, She'erit Israel is going to come up. Sorry, I got the names mixed up. She'erit Israel is the shul in South Carolina that he's going to go visit, which is going to cause a lot of the controversy. He gets to Albany in 1846. Among the reforms he established, this is assumed to be traditional shul, right? In America, there weren't like, oh, we're going to be a reform shul. They become that, but at this point, it was a traditional shul. And from the beginning, he started different things. He says here that he started mixing the choir. He got rid of the piyutim. Okay, not so crazy. Especially the way that America, American Jewry went afterwards, even Orthodox sense. Then he introduced German and English hymns, okay, so meaning not just Hebrew songs, but also other languages. And he started what ultimately is called, I don't know if he called it this at the beginning, a confirmation ceremony, which took the place of bar mitzvah ceremonies. Whatever bar mitzvah ceremony is, nowadays it still exists, confirmation, right? They have it in when they're older. Exactly, but it's like later on. I don't think it's at 13.
I think, I don't know if it's in Europe also, but in South America, my mother's son did.
Yeah.
This is a big part of the apartment.
Really? Okay, interesting. I guess if you're not doing any more mitzvahs once you've become bar mitzvah, so what's the point?
No, but yeah. It's
a passage. It's a
brick is a...
Right.
At least conservative synagogues, confirmation was held at high school graduation,
right.
Kind of a way.
Yeah.
I was coming of age type of thing, right? It's like, I was gonna say 18 years old. That's when they typically have it. I guess some of that, you know, I should feel like a little embarrassed that I don't know what other Jews do, but yeah. Oh, earlier. Don't worry about it. Not gonna hold. It's not in my contract. Then he said a couple other interesting things. He said that. He didn't like the selling of mitzvot. right? Like the Aliyahs and the Pesachs. He didn't like that. The Shul still did it, but he didn't outlaw it. But he didn't like it. And then he insisted that everybody sit during Kriyas HaTorah. I don't know why. I'd like to look into some of these, but that's not the topic for today, so I wasn't going to. But apparently he said that people should sit down for laning, which is in the halacha. You know, you can sit down. You don't have to stand up. You know, the Mishnah Berurah says that, you know, someone who wants to be extra pious should stand, but, you know, regular people could sit. So he insisted that everyone sit. I'm not sure why. He has a book, Reminiscences. I don't know if that's grammatical. Is reminiscences a word? Yeah, reminiscences. So he writes this book, which is, I think, like an autobiography, basically. And in there, he talks about a lot of these things, which you either can or can't trust, depending what the thing is. But from the outset, it says here I'm quoting from I'm quoting from an article by Rabbi Naftali J. Rubinger, who was the rabbi of Congregation Habanim in Chicago. I'm not familiar, but it was written in 1972. And it's a very interesting summary of everything that happened. Interestingly enough, the article is called Dismissal in Albany, but the heading of the PDF is called Dis in Albany, D-I-S-S. So I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but that's not what dismissal means. Okay, either way, so he already starts, you know, it's slowly introducing some of these things. But the difference with him was, it wasn't just he was reforming things. It wasn't out of apathy. Rabbi Wise was a very strong personality, as David implied before. He came to America with this fervor of, like, galvanizing them and creating a real movement. Like, he was like a real passionate person of conviction. And a lot of these things, they weren't just like, oh, I don't really think this is important. He's like, no, we shouldn't do this anymore. That kind of thing, right? He was very passionate about it. And then because of that, he came in conflict with many of the members of the Beth El community who resented the changes. Not just that, they resented the zeal with which the rabbi projected them. That's what the article says. It's one thing to not want this or that, but to force it and be so passionate about it was a different thing. So he continued to do these types of things. And slowly but surely, requests and petitions were directed to the board of the congregation to undo some of these reforms, right? So he's putting them down, and then the people are saying, let's get it, you know, let's put it back, you know, that kind of thing. And we're not just talking about when Seon is Mira, right? We're talking about mixing the seating of the shul, right? That's what he was trying to do. So, but Wise was able to muster sufficient support to sustain him in his position. By the summer of 1850, things had come to like a boil, right? Things were really getting off in a real contentious way. So, as the article here says, the final phase of storm and strife by the summer of 1850. Okay. So now, this article does tries very hard to figure out what happens in the lead up to it. Here is an article in August of 1850. So this definitely happens before the brawl, okay? So we'll just read this. To our mind, nothing is more clearly pointed out in Scripture than the promise of the resurrection of Israel and the awakening of the dead. Okay, this is in the Occident, right? This is by the editor.
Who's writing this?
I believe this is Lester. Right? There's nothing more clearly pointed out. So the Gemara says that in many places. The Gemara says, you know, anyone who believes that it's not written in the Torah is a kofar or whatever. Right? So there is absolute chiyas
amesim. So Lester knew news.
Yeah, no, they were very...
He was the first one to translate the entire Tanakh into English.
Really?
He was one of two, both around
okay.
The same time. You can still find his translation.
Okay, so Lester was very involved in Tanakh and translating and knowing what it said, but the reason why this is a discussion is because of what's going to happen, what they're going to say right now. Dr. Wise, in an unfortunate moment, in the ardor perhaps of a new position as a candidate for the ministry of a congregation, some members and the minister of which were supposed unwilling to receive our creed as it stood and yet stands, was hurried away to answer no to a question put to the minister referred to by a learned divine who maintained the side of correct faith. Now, that's a little bit wordy. Basically what happens like this, I'm going to say this outside because it does, a lot of this not only just gets jumbled because of the wording, but also because there's a debate as to what actually happened at this event. Earlier on in 1850, Isaac Mayer Wise goes to South Carolina, and he tells his congregation in Albany, "Oh, I'm going there to engage in a debate with this guy named Posnansky." Posnansky was a reformer. He had already started these reforms, not to mention that Sheriff Israel was already reformed, right? This place in South Carolina. So he's saying, "I'm going there as, you know, as part of a debate." There's another rabbi there. Who was fighting on behalf of, you know, of Orthodoxy. Reverend Dr. Raphael, which will come up in a couple of seconds. But so Rev. Raphael, in the heat of the moment, asks, because it was getting contentious, while they're in South Carolina, asks Rabbi Wise, "Do you believe in Mashiach? Do you believe in Tchiyas HaMeisim?" And he definitively says no on both. Right? This is the account that the board of the Albany Shul hears, okay? Rabbi Wise told them he was going to debate, but the impression was he was going to debate in support of Orthodox traditionalism. In reality, he went and actually did the opposite, okay? Not only that, but it turns out that when they reached out to Sheirat Israel in South Carolina, they were not holding a debate. They were holding a prava to see who would become their next rabbi. So he went to Sheirat Israel, which was a Reformed congregation by all intents and purposes at the time, right? He went to there for a Reformed congregation to try out to be the rabbi. And while being sort of like, you know, prebut about, you know, this whole thing, he says, "Oh yeah, don't worry, I don't believe in Mashiach, I don't believe in Tchiyas HaMeisim." And then this gets back to Albany, and they're like, "What in the world? Our rabbi said those things? It's enough that he's trying to mix the feeding and he's trying to do this and that. Now he's saying that he doesn't believe in two of the 13 principles of faith," right? So this is what happens, okay? The Occident is a very interesting periodical because they try very hard to get both sides of every argument, and they give space in their paper for each party to submit what they want to say. Okay. But what happens basically is, because obviously there's timing and there's, you know, just how often the periodical comes out, that one issue will sound like the Occident is siding with Wise, and then the next issue is like, "Oh, well, here's the other side of the issue." But like in the meantime, an entire month passed, and people were taking sides. So I find it very interesting sociologically. No, because the other side only sees what happens once they see the Occident the next month. It's a response, but it takes a while, right? So this is in August of 1850. This is the Albany's impression of what happened. Who would there be any disgrace in Dr. Wise acknowledging in calmer moments that he was mistaken? Meaning, okay, fine, maybe he was in a rush, maybe there was some kind of, you know, a big hullabaloo and he was asked in the middle of this whole event and he just spouted out, "No, I don't believe in that stuff," or something like that. So now we're asking, like, could you just like apologize, you know, make it right? And that the Bible supports the ancient hope of Israel. To our view, this course would be one of honor and glory, as it would be merely the overcoming a little the pride of opinion for the sake of truth, right? Just get over your ego a little bit, Rabbi Wise. And all lovers of peace would welcome him among them as an able champion of pure Judaism. We have always maintained and reiterated upon the present occasion that the broaching of new doctrines can only lead to disunion and estrangement of feelings, and we earnestly wish our reformers could be more conscious of the fact. I find that a fascinating, there's so much in this line, in this paragraph that I find fascinating. What is the Occident trying to do? While Rabbi Wise is trying to sort of reform and create a new American Judaism, you know, the Occident is like, whoa, pull back the reins for a second. Let's all stay on the same page. The 13 principles of faith, we're going to keep those, okay? We're not going to, you know, violate any of those. So this is the Occident talking to, talking to Rabbi Wise based on what they heard happened in South Carolina. Because you'll see the next paragraph is actually from South Carolina, it's from Albany. Okay, so we'll see that in a second. But here it sounds like the Occident is giving sort of like a little bit of a pointer and advice to Rabbi Wise. Like, listen, guys, get on board here or else we're going to have problems, right? That's what it sounds like. Beyond that, we have Isaac Lester, who had been on Rabbi Wise's side, and he knew him, you know, 10, 15 years ago. He gave him the position. He helped him get in position in Albany. He's like, look, guy, you know, look, man, I helped you out here. You know, help me out. Don't be so radical, right? So this is the next part. Sir, differences which have arisen in the congregation Beth El, right? So this is the Albany shul in this city, and which was threatened to affect alike the character and well-being of that congregation, make it my duty. This is, I believe, the board of Albany. Make it my duty to publish through the medium of your work this subjoined document and to ask all Jews, ministers, as well as competent laymen throughout these United States, whether a man who denies two fundamental articles of Jewish faith is a fit and proper person to hold the office of rabbi and preacher in a Jewish congregation. I am, sir, yours respectfully, Louis Spanier. Louis Spanier is the president of the shul, president of Congregation Bethel, okay? So he is airing the dirty laundry of the shul to everyone in America,
but
right?
The president and the board are the champions of tradition.
Exactly, yeah. It's the opposite of what you would think. But as we'll see in a second, it's a more complicated than that. We, the undersigned, at the request of Mr. L. Spanier, Louis Spanier, do herewith certify that we were present at a public controversy held in the city between Reverend Dr. Rafal and the Reverend Mr. Poznanski, and that at the said controversy, Reverend Dr. Rafal propounded their two questions to the meeting. The first was, do you believe in the coming of the Messiah? To which question Reverend Dr. Wise of Albany, who was present, it doesn't even sound like he was supposed to be there at this specific discussion, answered foremostly in a loud and distinct voice, no. The second question was, do you believe?
It might be simply that he was succeeded, but it wasn't hearsay. It was heard directly from him. In other words,
okay, it sounds like the debate was supposed to be between Rafal and Poznanski, and then Boise just butted in. But that's how it's presented here. And this is the first-hand account that was sent into the Occident to confirm what actually happened. The second question was, do you believe in the resurrection of the dead?
From South Carolina who wrote to Louis Spanier.
To tell him this has really happened. Because they had heard that this thing happened, and then Wise told them one thing, and it was really another thing. So now they went to ask South Carolina. South Carolina is now confirming this is exactly what happened. The question was, do you believe in the resurrection of the dead? The Reverend Dr. Wise was again heard by us to say in a loud and distinct voice, no. Okay, so there you have it. Rabbi Wise clearly said that he objects to two fundamental principles of faith in the South Carolina discussion. Okay. So now what happens is, and there's a lot that goes behind the scenes here, okay? So first of all, this is going to become the pretense for trying to depose Rabbi Wise, okay? The board doesn't like him. Clearly the president doesn't like him, as you can tell. They're now going to depose him. That is the superficial view of it. This article, fascinatingly enough, digs in a little deeper and says, this Rabbi Rubinger, says, wait a second, let's look a little deeper. It could very well be that there was a controversy before that. Because before this ever happens, before they tried to kick him out, two things take place. I don't know if this is here or not. Yeah, I don't think it's here. So basically, two things happen.
This is all being discussed in publication.
Right. Well, it's being aired publicly. Okay. So that's a great point. The board is going to do their job. But you have to know that in the middle of the 19th century, when American Judaism was so, like, spread apart and there was not much to do, these books, this Occident had literally, it had board meeting minutes from all the shuls. Like, tell us what's going on in American Judaism type of thing. So it wasn't just like, we're running to Mishpacha to tell everybody about this. So this is what the periodical was. But the point is, that, like, that's what this paper was for, was to tell other Jews in America what's going on in the other small communities in America. Right? It was sort of like the ingathering of the exiles, you know, telling everyone, which is a crazy thing to think about. Like, you know, do you know anything that's going on in Austin, Texas, the Jewish community? No, of course not. But back then, this is what the Occident was trying to do. Yeah.
It seems, at least at this point, that the argument against him is not because it's halakhically inappropriate. It's going to cause strife.
I mean, it is halakhically inappropriate, but...
No, what I'm saying, the argument they're using is, you know, this is too radical. It's going to separate us. It's not about.
Well, that's what the Occident is trying. They're trying to pull him back and say, no, don't believe
but
these things.
Not from a shuffling, but from a unity.
Right. Yeah, it's true. That's true.
I think if this is like the case of writing the first part,
yeah.
I think that, you know, in fairness to him, I think he was trying to be extremely polite.
Oh, yeah. That's, you see, that you find that all the time here.
He's trying to be polite.
Yeah, this is him being angry.
I don't think this is at least you're trying to say,
come on, man. Yeah, right.
I think this is him just being
right. He's saying it in a nice way, but he's like, come on, guys, get it together, that kind of thing. Basically, but there's two things in this article that I don't have here. This is just the Occident, which doesn't really air this laundry because this Rabbi Rumberger did a much deeper dive into what's going on. There were two individuals. One was on the board of the shul, and one was the local shochet, might have also been the chazan of the shul, that Rabbi Wise got into a tiff with. One was that Rabbi Wise, even though he was all for all these reforms, ironically, he was a very staunch proponent that anyone who's on the board has to be a Shomer Shabbos. This is a very interesting stance, and you know, obviously, to us that sounds obvious, but for him back then, it was like a thing. He wasn't going to let anyone on the board who wasn't Shomer Shabbos. And one guy who was close with this Louis Spaniard, the president of the shul, on the board, was not a Shomer Shabbos. So he sends a message to the board saying, hey, get rid of this guy, or I'm going to talk about him from the pulpit and say that he should be deposed from the board. This is what Rabbi Wise sends to Spanier, okay? Spanier says back, you better not do that, okay? And not only that.
Rabbi Wise wanted to get the non-Shomer Shabbos back off the board.
Yeah, he wanted to kick them Chal Shabbos.
No, but they're not usually.
Yeah, right. There's just two different things. They're picking and choosing. The Shabbos we're going to keep, but Tchias HaMeis we're not. Okay, it sounds weird to us, obviously.
When it comes to Shabbos in those days with Wise, I think the big issue was Jews owned businesses. Jews, I mean, there weren't
right.
big companies to hire you to do this and that. And so the big, really in-your-face thing
yeah.
is the Jew having his store open on Shabbos.
I think
that was... And I would strongly guess that this guy, whoever he was, had they owned the store and had the store open.
Yeah, it seems to be probably what it was.
As opposed to what you were doing, you know, I heard...
Right, I saw you writing something or whatever.
You know, pairs of toilet paper and
stuff. Ironically, later on, they're going to accuse Rabbi Wise of doing things like that. Smaller things, not a business or anything.
But Shabbos is something that you see clearly in the Torah. Kriyas Mason and all
of that... That's part of the point. So basically, what happens is, Rabbi Wise tells the board, I'm going to speak about him from the pulpit. And the board says, okay, fine. If you're going to speak about him from the pulpit, you know what? You're not speaking from the pulpit. And he says, and they tell Rabbi Wise, you're not allowed to speak from the pulpit. Now, this is from other places. The Occident never reports any of this. But the Spaniard tells him, you can't speak from the pulpit. The next Shabbos, he starts getting up to speak. And Spaniard tries to shout him down and tells him to sit down. And he pushes through and he doesn't sit down. Now, he didn't speak about the board member at the speech, but it was this big thing that, like, what are you doing? You're not listening to the president, whatever. So that's one thing. Then there's a man named Traub. His first name was like Vest. Is that a name? Veist? V-E-I-S-T? Veist? I don't know. Either way, he was the local shochet and the chazan. And at one point, unclear why, because this article tries very hard to figure it out, there was some kind of libel suit against him in court, literally in court. And Rabbi Wise tells the congregation, you can't eat from his shechita anymore. Now, why can't you eat from his shechita? So if you look on the back of the page here.
Rabbi Wise, who 50 years later was infamous for the
yes,
Treif banquet.
The Treif banquet at the first, what was that, the first graduation of HUC or something?
It was many years after.
Many years after? Okay. Either way.
It was a graduation.
Okay. Furthermore, Mr. S., this is the top of the page. This is written in 9 November 1850. Mr. S., Mrs. Spanier, exhibited to us the books of the congregation from which it appears that the interruption which Dr. Wise experienced when he attempted to preach was owing to the fear Mr. S. had that it would create unpleasant scenes in which Dr. Wise would carry out this threat addressed to a member of the board to allude to him in his sermon relative to his, the trustee's, violation of the Shabbat. Dr. Wise, we were farther assured, suspended Mr. Traub, the shochet, upon a misconception of the oath Mr. Traub took before the police magistrate and that so far from willfully alleging a falsehood, Mr. Traub stated that others had also heard though Dr. Raj explained his words so as to contradict the statement thus made under oath. Wherefore, it's a he said type of thing. Oh no, there's two things. There's the Michal Shabbos and then there's the Mr. Traub. Traub is the one he's saying took an oath. Okay, that sounds like he had committed to something according to the court, which might be referring to this libel suit that they had together. So and he breached that oath. Wherefore, the suspension of Mr. T, right, Traub, on the part of the rabbi was an undue stretch of authority. Meaning, Rabbi Weiss doesn't own the shochet. He doesn't own the local slaughtering house. So why should he get to suspend the shochet? Because he didn't like what he did to him. Right? So there's something about this that there's more to it.
But I think it seems that it's the oath that Mr. Traub took.
So we don't know what the oath was. We don't know what the oath was. I can tell you for sure that... So the story is like this. So this Rabbi Rumbinger tries to figure it out. I think I pronounced his name like six different times, six different ways. But he tries to figure out what was going on there. In one letter, I believe in his autobiography, that Rabbi Wise says that this Mr. Traub was opposed to him because he frequented the saloon. That's what it says, and he got drunk all the time. He liked the L'chaim. He was Hasidish. I don't know. Right, exactly. But as this article rightly points out in the footnote, there's no such disqualification just because you drink. Just because if you were drunk while you're doing this, that's a different story. But just because you go to a saloon doesn't mean you can't be a shochet. So that's what the Occident knew. But really, behind the scenes, there were other things going on the Occident didn't know. So that's why I'm saying the Occident doesn't have all the information. They only have the information that was presented. No, so this article tries to figure it out, but it can't. But the point is that he claims this, and then as you see in Shulchan Aruch here, but there are some things that are pasul la'edus, even if you're pasul la'edus, like if you're drunk, so then you'd be pasul la'edus, but that wouldn't possibly you from being a shochet. That's in the Hebrew here from your day, at the beginning of your day. Just because you go and you get a drink sometimes doesn't mean you can't be a shochet. It might not be the best person for the job, but we're talking about, 1850s in Albany. It's not like there are a dime a dozen, shochetim already.
Did Rabbi Wise have some sort of, shkacha over him at the
shochet? No, doesn't seem like that. He was never appointed in that capacity.
He was like an independent shochet
that
everybody
Yeah, it seems like that. It seems like that, which is why they were upset about it. You can't do that to Mr. Traub. Now, it also happens to be the Occident didn't know this either, that not only did Rabbi Wise, depose Traub, he also appointed a different shochet. So I don't know if that was one of his supporters or somebody else in the community he was trying to do something for, but that was another wrinkle to the situation. So he's ruffled the feathers of two prominent members of the shul, three prominent members. One is Spanier, but that was also in response to the other person who was Michal Shabbos and the shochet. So you've got three prominent members of the shul that really don't like Rabbi Wise already, okay? Now, because of all of this coming together, then South Carolina happens, or they hear about South Carolina, and all of this together is like, okay, we got to get rid of this guy, okay? This is where it comes to a head. On the 5th of September, it seems like Rosh Hashanah was the 6th or the 7th of September. 5th of September, when Dr. Wise was deposed in his absence by a majority of votes. Now, that is a loaded statement. That sounds like, okay, fine, what's the big deal? Turns out that this meeting didn't actually take place at a normal time. It says here, a regular meeting. It was not a regular meeting. It was done in the middle of the day as opposed to in the afternoon when they usually have their meetings. It was done after some people in the meeting left in opposition. They just said, if we're not staying here, we're going. So when it says here, in his absence by a majority of votes, what it means is they did it at an irregular time so Rabbi Wise couldn't be there. And they did it after people left, so yes, they had the majority of votes. The Occident doesn't know that at this time. The consequence of which he was notified that his contract was declared void and that he could not be allowed to officiate any longer. Dr. Wise and his friends thought his dismissal illegal, and hence the unfortunate exhibition of bad feelings on the new year, which caused the sheriff to turn out the people from the place of worship. Now, They don't explain what happened. Why did the sheriff come up? I'll tell you in a second. Okay, Dr. Eisenstein, on Sukkot only, it was that. The key having been restored to Mr. Spanier, the thing that was reported, reopened, and attended by the portion that had not seceded with Dr. Wise. Basically, the second day of Rosh Hashanah, after this whole thing happened, he split off and made a minion in his own house. Since then, they have formed two separate congregations, giving Dr. Wise a sum of $800 for his past services. That was what he was owed for the last 6 months, $800. Yeah. I think it was 6 months. Giving Dr. Wise a sum of $800. All lawsuits have at the same time been dropped by both parties, right? Just get away from us, we won't bother you anymore. We have endeavored to give a concise, though faithful statement of this lamentable occurrence, and our readers can form their own judgment of the whole without our giving an opinion. Still, it must strike everyone that, let us blame Dr. Wise as we must, things would not have proceeded to the length that they did if there had been... So this next line is actually very important sociologically for what the Austin tries to do. Let us blame Dr. Wise as we must. Things would not have proceeded to the length that they did if there had been laws to define the duties and privileges of the minister, and if there had been a central board of reference for all American congregations. The Austin is saying, we need a rabbinic conference, which ultimately, ironically, Rabbi Wise creates for the first time. Right? Rabbi Wise creates the CCAR, the conference, I don't know, I forgot what they're called. Central Conference of American Rabbis, there you go.
And the Union of American Hebrew
Rabbis. Right. He creates basically two institutions which become the headquarters of all rabbis and congregations of the Reform Movement.
The three.
Well, the college. Right. So he gets rabbis, congregations, and then the actual rabbinical seminary, the Hebrew Union College. So this whole scene is what precipitates him to move down to Cincinnati. He does break off in 1850 and has his shul for a few years, but only, I think, in 1854, he moves to Cincinnati and creates this whole institutionalized reform movement. But this is what really spurs him in recognizing, like, okay, my vision is not going to happen as long as these people are in charge. Now, while you think that's interesting, listen to the version of Rabbi Rumbinger, who has different sources. Okay. So first of all, it says here, this was the document which was forwarded to Wise informing him of the action of the congregation, okay? To Dr. Wise in Albany, by the regular quarterly meeting of the congregation Bethel, held the 5th of September 1850, it was resolved that the majority of the congregation Bethel, after a long consult, which apparently was spelled wrong, I don't know why, but about different accusations and complaints against the rabbi Dr. Isaac M. Wise, of said complaints Dr. Wise received on the third day of July, a copy, right? So they had already said, hey, we don't like what you're doing. And there was a long list of things. You did this on Rosh Hashanah, you did this on Shavuot, a bunch of things. But here it says that the contract between the congregation of Bethel, one part, and the rabbi Dr. Isaac Meir Wise, another part, shall be considered void, and two, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise shall be discharged from the congregation of Bethel from his office as a rabbi and preacher commencing as of today, the 5th of September, 1850. And three, a copy of the resolution shall be forwarded to Rabbi Dr. Isaac Meir Wise, Albany, the 6th of September, 1850. The people signed on it. Louis Spanier, president. Vice Traub, the secretary. Also the shofar. The impression that Wise sought to communicate was that the majority of the members assembled for the meeting were in support of the rabbi, and that had the meeting taken in natural course of action, Wise would have been exonerated and sustained. Meaning, in his own book, The Reminiscences, he says, well, people were supportive of me, but they all left, and that's why the vote went forward. The truth is, as this article points out, if this is so, why did Sporberg, one of Wise's staunchest supporters, seek an adjournment of the meeting? Why did he try to cancel the meeting? Would it not have been in the interest of Wise and his friends to permit the charges against him to be brought to a vote, thereby giving the majority of the assembled the most potent instrument of their support of Wise? Meaning, if the majority of the people at the meeting were in support of him, so then have the vote, and you would have won the vote, right? Wise's excuse, they kicked everybody out of the meeting. No, they didn't. If they wanted to, they could have just stayed and they had the vote. They left in... in protest or something. But it's not just that. But later on, they said, yeah, most people would have sided with me. Well, if they would have, then you wouldn't have left. right? That's his point. At best, an adjournment would have retained the status quo for all of its confusion, indecision, bitterness, and tension. Furthermore, having failed in their attempt to have the meeting adjourned, why did they decide to leave the meeting, thus assuring Spanier and his friends the absolute majority? Is it not more reasonable to assume that Spanier had enjoyed the majority? Therefore, Sporberg, this was one of his supporters, and his party sought an adjournment of the meeting to gain time in order to change the tide of ill will encompassing the rabbi. Meaning, they had only minority. Like, whoa, we don't have the votes here. Let's cancel the meeting, right? They tried to cancel the meeting so they could try to convince other people before having the vote.
It's kind of strange, though, if they formally adjourned the meeting.
No, they wanted to. Spanier's like, no, we're not adjourning just because you don't have the numbers, right? They're looking around and saying, we don't have the numbers.
So
Spanier's like, okay, so let's have the vote.
The Democrats have Texas, and they left before it was formally adjourned, so it wasn't adjourned.
Correct. They wanted it to be adjourned. Spanier said no. It wasn't adjourned, so then they left anyway. We come now to the last and most dramatic phase of this intra-congregational struggle. This is not in the paper. Wise, in consultation with his friends and legal counsel, was advised to inform Spanier of his intention of remaining the rabbi of the congregation and of officiating a Rosh Hashanah service the following day. Rosh Hashanah is September 7th. They tell him that he's fired on September 6th. Wise says, sorry, I'm coming. Okay. He therefore dispatched the following communication to Spanier. This is what he sends him. I don't know how they send him. I guess they sent him a note down the street or something. In answer to your letter of September 6th last, meaning yesterday, I guess.
It says Erev Yontif.
I have it's signed September 6th, 1850. Okay? And he's saying, in answer to your letter of September 6th, meaning that I got earlier today, I have to advise you that in keeping with my rights and in accordance with the desires of the majority of the trustees of the Congregation Beth El, I will remain in my position and I will continue in my duties as before. Okay, this is September 6th. Comes September 7th. Actually, September 6th at night. Apparently, the evening services, this is what the article says, the evening services of September 6th passed without any incident. The following morning, however, when Wise arrived at the synagogue, he found that his seat on the pulpit had been taken. Someone else was sitting there. I don't know who. He therefore seated himself elsewhere. Wise's own words depict the mood of grave excitement that pervaded the congregation. Okay, so this is Wise's own words. Okay, keep that in mind. Everything was as quiet as a grave. Interesting way to start a paragraph. As quiet as a grave. Finally, the choir sings Psalter's Great In Kamoka. I have no idea. You know what that is?
I know exactly.
You? That's the one that we use?
It's used in Orthodox schools for...
That's the In Kamoka that we sing? Is Psalter's?
Well, I
can
sing it for you
later. Okay. Okay, interesting. So he says, I'm not familiar with it. Seltzer is great in Kamocha. At the conclusion of the song, I step before the ark in order to take out the scrolls of the law as usual. What he doesn't say here is that, remember how he said he doesn't like the selling of kibbutim? They were still doing it, and his supporters put up the money so that he could get psicha. That's what happened, right? So they paid for it, and then they told him to go up and do psicha, okay? He doesn't say that, but that's what happened. Okay. Take those goes to laws, and to offer prayer, Spanier steps in my way and, without saying a word, smites me with his fist so that my cap falls from my head. This is what he said, okay? This was the terrible signal for an uproar, the like of which I had never experienced. The people acted like furies. It was as though the synagogue had suddenly burst forth into a flaming conflagration. The Poles and the Hungarians, who thought only of me, struck out like wild men. The young people jumped down from the choir gallery to protect me and had to fight their way through the surging crowd. Within 2 minutes, the whole assembly was a struggling mass. The sheriff and his posse, who were summoned, little does he know, Spanier knew all along that Wise was coming and was going to start this, and Spanier knew he was going to start this, so he had already called the sheriff the day before. He told the sheriff to come to the shul the next day, so it wasn't like, oh, someone get the sheriff. It wasn't like that. The sheriff was on call, right? He was standing right there. Who were summoned were belabored and forced out until finally the whole assembly surged out of the house into Herkimer Street. Louis Spanier, I said to him, this is Wise saying over what happened. there is the law to which I can appeal, right? So he's going, I got a contract, you can't, you know, can't kick me out. He replied, this is a fascinating response, a real bored president here, I have $100,000 more than you. I do not fear the law, I will ruin you. That's what he says. I've got more money, you're done for. I finally reached home, bowed with pain and irrepressible grief. Okay, I'm not sure how grief-stricken he was. He didn't want to be there anyway, but this is how it was his rendition. Wise did not mention the scheme agreed upon by his friend. This is the author of the article now. To assure his presence on the pulpit that day, his supporters decided to purchase for him the honor of taking the Star Scroll from the Ark. Spanier, upon hearing this arrangement, declared all purchases of honors made on the previous day to be null and void, thus denying the opposition the advantage of conferring his honor upon the rabbi. Right? So Spanier knew what was going on. Right? So Wise presents it as if, I got this. I went up to get the Torah, and they just socked me in the face. Really, the whole thing had already been played out beforehand. Spanier, in his defense, claimed that rumors of trouble and the atmosphere of ill will that prevailed had compelled him to seek the assistance of the sheriff's office even prior to the Rosh Hashanah outbreak. Right? So Wise has got one version of the event. Spanier's got the other. After Wise arrived home, a local constable arrested him and escorted him to the police station, where the whole rabble was present to feast their eyes on the sight of their rabbi appearing in court on New Year's Day, right? So everyone's like, hey, look at the rabbi. He's in court on Rosh Hashanah, right? Nothing ever happened of this because there were two sides to the story. Spanier, I guess we're all good. Very good. Very good. So I think that's a different oath. I think that was between him and the Shochet. It could be. You could be right. But...
Did this change Rabbi Wise's opinion?
Yeah, that was Mr. Chief at the
oath. Did this whole instance change his opinion about Orthodox Judaism? It kind of like said...
Embolden him? Like, I can't work with these guys?
I can't work with people who have these old...
It could be, but he was already doing things before. So it's hard to say that, like, this might have spurred him to create the whole organization because he knew he couldn't work with them. But philosophically, he was already off.
Exactly.
Right, he was like...
It seems at this point, Yom Kippur was canceled, too.
Well, they split. Well, okay, so the shul didn't get their keys back until Sukkot.
Right.
So I don't know where the other people davened. They might have had a house meeting also. I don't know. But he certainly davened in his house.
Yeah.
The police judge, however, treated Wise with courtesy and permitted him to return to his home. Services for the second day of Rosh Hashanah were held in Wise's home for his supporters, and we may assume that for the other segment of the congregation, arrangements were made either in private homes or possibly at the Beth El Jacob Synagogue, since the police has confiscated the keys of Beth El, meaning they might have gone to a different shul. The other shul was also called Beth El Jacob. Closed the premises of Republic use. The first phase of the era of Isaac Meir Wise was now history. The ties that had bound the members of Beth El congregation since 1838 were torn asunder. However illegal Louis Spanier's actions may have been, the relations between Wise and Beth El were at an end. The multiplicity of cases of causes contributed to Wise's dismissal from the Beth El pulpit. No single issue compelled Spanier to deprive Wise of his ministerial charge in Albany. Spanier had been challenged by the following facts. Number one, Wise had delivered an offensive sermon contrary to the president's request, right? That's when he would try to stop him. Wise had arbitrarily discharged the ritual slaughterer and may have engaged another in his place without the consent of the congregation, right? Not his authority. Three, Wise had been involved in a lawsuit and charged with libel. That's the one with the Shochet, I think. Another one with the Shochet. Number four, Wise was accused of heresy. That was the South Carolina thing. Number five, in consequence of all this, Traub had threatened to resign from his office of Chazon. Right? So Spanier's dealing with these five things. Like, what am I supposed to do with all this? If I just get rid of Wise, I'll take care of all of them. Right? None of them are a problem anymore. Spanier was convinced that Wise had, by the willful, overbearing, and intemperate exercise of his ministerial office, threatened the already shaky peace and harmony of the congregation. He had made up his mind, therefore, to sever relations between Beth El and Wise. And that's why it all came to a head on Rosh Hashanah. So that was the final nail in the coffin of the Rosh Hashanah day. Yeah, we don't. You know, the most excited we get is whether we say for youth or not. Yeah, that's how. That could be. Hold on, I'm trying to see. Okay, so the September 1850 is just more in the Occident. But then I found an interesting article in December of 1850 about Dr. Wise in Philadelphia. Now, December of 1850, he's long gone, right? He's no longer. But Wise is now trying to promote his sort of new ideology of change, of an American Judaism, right? He goes to Philadelphia as an attempt to sort of teach them about, of change and reform. We cannot follow Dr. Wise in his whole lecture, right? So he basically, Rabbi Wise went through this whole spiel, and they say, we can't go through all of it here in the Occident, but suffice to say like this, for want of space, but he certainly treated his subject both ably and ingeniously. Still, we must say that the reforms effected by Sadja and Maimonides in their generations, as also by Rabbi Yehuda HaKadosh in the compilation of the Mishnah, bear scarcely any analogy to the measures at present advocated by our new men. Basically, Wise goes to Philadelphia and says, look, people have done this before. Sadja made new pronouncements, and the Rambam made new takanos, right? And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi wrote down the Mishnah even though it wasn't supposed to, right? So people have made reforms. Now it's time for us to make our own reforms, right? This is what he's saying to the congregation. However, now Philadelphia is writing back and says, whoa, 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 not so fast. Then it was to restore the beauty of religion, which had been dimmed by the lapse of ages of darkness. Whereas now, men endeavor to break down the landmarks of our faith by introducing into it features hostile to its very existence. Witness the abolishing of circumcision, the seventh day of Sabbath, the prohibitions and the interdict to intermarry with strangers. Compared to such monstrosities, all the synagogue reforms, no matter however unjustifiable, sink into nothing. And hence, it says much to compare the ancient with modern reforms, as there can be no companionship between Sadja and Solomon and Meir, Alfasi and Geiger and Holdheim. I don't know who Holdheim is.
By the way, Geiger said that Isaac Meir Wise was a student of Rappaport.
Right. Geiger was involved with the academic.
He lived in the home for a long time.
Of Rappaport?
Shimshon Rafael
Hirsch. Oh, yeah, Geiger. Yeah. I know the name Geiger. Abraham?
Abraham Geiger.
Yeah.
The teacher doesn't necessarily produce a...
Right, it's not the same. Apple fell far from the tree. Yeah.
The apple can fall.
Exactly. Maimonides and Stein and Kreitznach. You know who that is? I don't know Kreitznach. Mm-hmm. Sounds like Kratzmach, but
yeah.
Okay. We admit the learning of the new lights. We recognize, you know, their scholarship, but we must doubt their wisdom, even if we concede them the honesty of purpose which they claim, meaning they're being sincere, but we still can't go with it. For the present, we must close with these remarks. But should we continue at the head of a Jewish periodical, we shall to a certainty have to recur to the subject again. Since the reform agitation has taken of late such a shape that to ignore it would be worse than nonsense, and then the ultraists have calmed down greatly, seeing that their ideas would be the ruin of Judaism. Avi Oxen is saying basically, we've got to talk about this. You know, we can't let this fly. We can't let him go around and say these things without responding to them. Meaning, it would be more nonsensical to say nothing than to oppose it in the pages of the Oxen. So they don't want to cause divisiveness. They don't want to separate the Jewish people. But what can I do? What can I do? My hands are tied. We've got to stop this guy. Obviously, it didn't work. He goes on to Cincinnati only a few years later, and starts the reform movement. So while we usually talk about more halakhic issues, this is somewhat halakhic. It had other areas of halakha in terms of the Yud Gimel Ikarim. And it had the thing about the Shochtim and had other things. This is more of a historical thing about where Orthodoxy in America was in 1850. You're dealing with a shul which was trying to be reformed and held its ground. Now, we, looking back, look at it sort of like on Spaniard's side, right? We want him to be the... But the truth is, Spaniard, you know, probably also, you know, was violating some of the norms and you know, took very harsh and radical actions to make sure that he could get Wise out. Now, he was trying to get Wise out, which was the right thing. The way he went about it was probably not as befitting. It probably ends up being a reform shul, if I had to guess anyway.
It did.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, that's quickly. 15 years later, in the 1890s, Bethel merged with Wise's breakaway. Wise was long gone.
They coalesced. They came back together.
The two came back together, coalesced, and it's still in existence.
Oh, yeah. Bethel exists? I usually look into it. I didn't know.
Called something else.
Okay.
After the merger, it was called something else. And it still exists to this day.
Yeah.
Thoroughly reformed.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that Wise was able to do those original reforms just implied that they were open to them. Even if they didn't like how radical he went, they were still open to it. So you just saw the writing on the wall for that shul or that community generally. But Either way, that's a little bit about Isaac Meir Weiss. He goes on to Cincinnati and really establishes this as a real ideology, more than just his trying to infiltrate the Orthodox shul. I think the shul is named after him now, Isaac Meir Weiss Temple or something in Cincinnati. Nice big building, looks just like a church, although some in New York City look at churches too, but that's not for now. The point is that this is really the beginning of American Reform Judaism. It existed before, but never like what he created once he moved to Cincinnati. So that's the Rosh Hashanah Baral of 1850. There's a lot to be said. There's a wonderful book. I think it's a wonderful book, just based on based on the table of contents and the research that I know this guy does, by Rabbi Zev Ellis, who is a really Jewish historian. I think he runs a school now in Philadelphia or something. But he has a book about early confrontations between rabbis and boards, and this is sort of like the prime example of it. Yeah, right, exactly. I'm interested to it. I asked him for it. It's like really expensive. It's like one of these like Harvard Press books that you can't get. You have to like print it every time you buy it. But it's a fascinating looking book. The Synagogue and its Board, or something like that. I can look it up. Hold on.
We've had the shul over different issues where there were disputes between rabbis and boards and members and so on a few times. And they didn't elevate to this, but
right.
You see the heat, the heated discussions that, at the shul membership
It's called Who Rules the Synagogue? Religious Authority and the Formation of American Judaism. So it's called, let me see. I don't even know if you can buy it. This came out in 2016, 344 pages.
Wow. I guess there's a lot of folks in the big boys.
Yeah, especially early on. That's what the Austin was getting at. Like, we need to set rules for these types of things. Now we have the Young Israel bylaws, we have the OU has something. But generally, it's not something you can pin down for everybody. It's $110 on Amazon.
accepting